stop sleeping and praying in doorways and bus stations. In Germany, Mahmoud and his family could make new lives for themselves. Mahmoud could finally find a way to reconnect with Walid. They could find Hannah, get his dad laughing and joking again, find peace for his mom. After coming so far, after losing so much, it felt like Mahmoud and his family were almost to the promised land. All they had to do was make room in their hearts for Germany, the way it had made room for them, and accept this strange new place as their home. "Yes," Mahmoud's father said, a smile slowly growing on his face. "A thousand times yes."
Isabel, Miami, Florida, 1994. Home. This was the coda to Isabel's song. She stood with a trumpet in hand, a gift from Uncle Guillermo, Lito's brother. She wasn't on a sidewalk in Havana, but in a classroom in Miami. It was her second week of school and the first day of band class, the day they auditioned for their places in the orchestra. Isabel twiddled her fingers on the trumpet's keys. She couldn't believe she was standing here in this classroom, less than a month after stumbling onto Miami Beach with her baby brother in her arms. So much had changed so quickly. After her mother and brother had been taken to the hospital and given a clean bill of health, Lito's brother Guillermo took them in until they found a little apartment of their own. His apartment was smaller than their house in Cuba, and not near the beach, but if Isabel never saw the ocean again, that was fine by her. Little Mariano was at home, getting fat and happy along with the other babies Mommy was paid to watch at the little in-house daycare she ran. Papi had gotten a job driving a taxi and was saving up for a car of their own. Señora Castillo planned to go back to school to become an American lawyer, and Señor Castillo was already talking to someone about getting a loan to open a restaurant. Luis got work in a little bodega, and Amara in a dress shop, and once Amara became a U.S. citizen, she planned to become a Miami police officer. They were going to be married in the winter. And Isabel? She had started the sixth grade. It was hard because she didn't speak English yet, but there were other Cuban kids there, lots more Cuban kids, a few who had come to America by boat like her, but more who had been born here, Cubano-Americanos, who still spoke Spanish at home. Isabel had quickly made friends, girls and boys who were warm and welcoming, and she knew she would learn to speak English like her teachers soon enough. She was practicing by watching lots and lots of television. At least, that's what she told her parents. She would learn, and in the meantime, math and Spanish and art class all still made sense. And so did music. Señor Villanueva and the other students waited for her to play. Isabel had practiced for weeks for this moment. At first, she couldn't decide what song to play, but then, while watching a baseball game with her father, she had figured it out. Isabel adjusted Ivan's Industriales baseball cap on her head, took a deep breath, and began to play the Star-Spangled Banner, the national anthem of the United States. But she didn't play it like she'd heard it at baseball games on the television. She played it like a son cubano, offbeat with a guajeo melody. Isabel played it salsa for Ivan lost at sea, and for Lito back in Cuba. She played it salsa for her mother and her father, who had left their homeland, and for her little brother Mariano, who would never know the streets of Havana the way she had. And Isabel played it salsa for herself, so she would never forget where she came from, who she was. Soon, Isabel had everyone in the room clapping along to the beat with her. But as she played, she heard a different rhythm, a beat underneath the one everyone else was clapping to. Her foot tapped in time with the hidden cadence, and she realized with a thrill that she was finally hearing it. She was finally counting clave. Lito was wrong. She didn't have to be in Havana to hear it, to feel it, She had brought Cuba with her to Miami. Isabel finished with a flourish, and Señor Villanueva and the other students cheered. She thought she might cry for happiness, but she bit back her tears. She had done enough crying over Iván and Lito. The song of her leaving Cuba to find a new home was over. Today, it was time to start a new song.
Mahmoud, Berlin, Germany, 2015. Home. A German song Mahmoud had never heard before played on the radio of the van that took him and his family through the streets of Berlin. The capital of Germany was the biggest city he had ever seen, far bigger than Aleppo. It was filled with nightclubs and cafes and shops and monuments and statues and apartments and office buildings. Almost all the signs were in German, but here and there he saw a sign in Arabic advertising a clothing store or a restaurant or a market. Buildings lined the sidewalks like 10-story walls of brick and glass, and cars and bicycles and buses and trams rattled and honked and clanged by in the streets. This strange, frightening, exciting place was to be Mahmoud's new home. The German government had taken in Mahmoud and his family. For the past 4 weeks, the four of them had lived in a school in Munich that had been turned into simple but clean housing for refugees. They had stayed there, free to come and go as they pleased, until a host family agreed to let them share their home, while Mahmoud's parents got on their feet. A host family here, on this street, in the capital of the country. The van pulled up to the curb outside a little green house with white shutters and an A-frame roof. Flowers filled the window boxes like Mahmoud had seen in Austria, and two German cars were parked in the driveway. Across the street in a park, teenagers did tricks on skateboards. Mahmoud's father slid open the side door for them to climb out, and Mahmoud and his mother and brother grabbed the backpacks filled with the clothes, toiletries, and bedrolls the German relief workers had given them. The relief worker who'd driven them led Mahmoud's mother and father and brother up the steps to the front door of the little house. But Mahmoud stood for a moment on the sidewalk, looking around at the neighborhood. Mahmoud knew from his history class back in Syria that Berlin had been all but destroyed by the end of World War II, reduced to a pile of rubble like Aleppo was now. Would it take another 70 years for Syria to return from the ashes the way Germany had? Would he ever see Aleppo again? Cries of joy and welcome came from the porch, and Mahmoud followed his family up the steps. His mother was being hugged by an elderly German woman, and an elderly German man was shaking hands with his father. The German relief worker had to translate everything everyone said to each other. Mahmoud and his family didn't speak German yet, and the family apparently didn't speak any Arabic. The German family had at least managed a sign written in Arabic that said, "Welcome home," on it, even if the expression they had used was a bit formal. Mahmoud still appreciated the effort. It was better than he could do in German. The man shaking hands with his father turned to Mahmoud and Walid, and what Mahmoud saw surprised him. He was a really old man. He had wrinkly white skin and thin white hair that stuck out a bit on the sides, like he tried to comb it, but it wouldn't stay put. When the relief worker had told them they'd be staying with a German family, Mahmoud had imagined a family like his own, not like his grandparents. "His name is Saul Rosenberg," the relief worker translated, "and he says welcome to your new home." As Mahmoud shook the old man's hand, he spotted a small, thin, ornate wooden box attached to the frame just outside the front door. Mahmoud recognized the symbol on the box. It was the Star of David, the same symbol on the flag of Israel. Mahmoud tried not to show his surprise. Not only was this couple old, they were Jewish. Back in the Middle East, Mahmoud knew, Jews and Muslims had been fighting each other for decades. This was a strange new world. Herr Rosenberg's wife broke away from Mahmoud's mother and bent down to say hello. She was a wide woman, white-haired like her husband, with big round glasses and a gap-toothed friendly smile. From the pockets of her frock, she withdrew a little stuffed rabbit made of white corduroy and offered it to Walid. His eyes lit up as he took it from her. "Frau Rosenberg made it herself. She's a toy designer," the translator explained. The old woman said something directly to Mahmoud. "She says she would have made one for you too," the translator said, "but she thought you might be too old for stuffed animals." Mahmoud nodded. "She can make one for my little sister, though, when we find her," he told the relief worker. "We had to hand her off to another boat to save her when we were drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. It was my fault. I'm the one who told my mother to do it, and now I have to find her and bring her back." Frau Rosenberg looked questioningly at the relief worker as he translated, and her bright smile faded. Walid ran off to show his mother his new toy, and the old woman led Mahmoud into the hallway just inside the house where family pictures hung on the wall. "I was a refugee once, just like you," the old woman said through the interpreter, "and I lost my brother." She pointed to an old brown photograph in a picture frame of a mother and father and two children, a boy about Mahmoud's age in glasses and a little girl. The father and son wore suits and ties, and the mother wore a pretty dress with big buttons. The girl was dressed like a little sailor. "That's Mizeo, the girl. That's my family. We left Germany on a ship in 1939, trying to get to Cuba, to escape the Nazis. I was very little then, and I'm very old now, and I don't remember too much about that time. But I do remember my father being very sick, and a cartoon about a cat, I remember that, and a very nice policeman who let me wear his hat. My father was the only one to make it to Cuba. He lived there for many years, long after the war, but I never saw him again. He died before we could find each other. The rest of us couldn't leave the ship with him, and no other country would take us. So they brought us back to Europe, just in time for the war. Just in time to go on the run again. The Nazis caught us, and they gave my mother a choice. Save me, or save my brother. Well, she couldn't choose. How could she? So my brother chose for her. His name was Joseph. Mahmoud watched as she reached out and gently touched the boy in the photograph, leaving a smudge on the glass. He was about your age, I think. I don't remember much about him, but I do remember he always wanted to be a grown-up. "I don't have time for games," he would tell me. "I'm a man now." And when those soldiers said one of us could go free and the other would be taken to a concentration camp, Joseph said, "Take me." My brother. Just a boy, becoming a man at last. She paused a moment, then took the picture down off the wall, reverently, with both hands. "They took my mother and my brother away from me that day, and left me alone there in the woods. I only survived because a kind old French lady took me in. She told the next Nazis who came knocking that I was family. When the war was over and I was old enough, I came back here to Germany to look for my mother and brother. I searched for them a long time, but they had died in the concentration camps. Both of them." The woman drew a breath. "I only have this picture of them because a cousin kept it, a cousin who was hidden away by a Christian family throughout the war. Here in Germany, I met my husband, Saul. He had also survived the Holocaust. We stayed because he had family here, and we made a family of our own," Frau Rosenberg said. She spread her arms wide and turned in the little hallway, showing Mahmoud the dozens of pictures of her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She put her hand to the old yellowed picture of her family again. They died so I could live. Do you understand? They died so all these people could live. All the grandchildren and nieces and nephews they never got to meet. But you'll get to meet them, she told Mahmoud. You're still alive, and so is your little sister, somewhere. I know it. You saved her, and together we'll find her, yes? I promise. We'll find her and bring her home. Mahmoud started to cry, and he turned away and tried to blink back his tears. The old Jewish woman put her arms around him and pulled him into a tight hug. Everything's going to be all right now, she whispered. We'll help you.
Ruthie, come here,
Frau Rosenberg's husband called to her. Mahmoud didn't need the translator to tell him that Herr Rosenberg wanted them to join him in the living room. Mahmoud dragged a sleeve across his wet eyes, and Frau Rosenberg tried to hang the picture back on the wall. Her old hands were too shaky, though, and Mahmoud took it from her and hung it back on its nail for her. His gaze lingered on the picture. He was filled with sadness for the boy his age, the boy who had died so Ruthie could live. But Mahmoud was also filled with gratitude. Joseph had died so Ruthie could live and one day welcome Mahmoud and his family into her house. The old woman gave Mahmoud's arm a squeeze, and she led him into the living room. Mom and Dad were there, and Walid, and Herr Rosenberg, and the space was bright and alive and filled with books and pictures of family and the smell of good food. It felt like a home.
This is Kyla Garcia. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of Refugee by Alan Gratz. Joseph's story was read by Michael Goldstrom. Isabel's story was read by Kyla Garcia. And Mahmoud's story was read by Asaf Cohen. This program was produced at Dion Audio and directed by Kyle Verville. Executive producer Paul R. Gagne. Original music by Scotty Huff. Editing and mastering by Alex Martinez. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, an imprint of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2017 by Alan Gratz. Production copyright 2017 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Author's note. Joseph, Isabel, and Mahmoud are all fictional characters, but their tales are based on true stories. Joseph. The MS St. Louis was a real ship that set sail from Nazi Germany in 1939 with 937 passengers on board, almost all of them Jewish refugees trying to escape the Nazis. The Jews expected to be admitted to Cuba, some of them to live there permanently, some to stay only temporarily until they were admitted to the United States or to Canada. But when they arrived, the Jews were told they would not be allowed to land. The reason was political. The Cuban official who had issued the refugees' entrance visas had fallen out of favor with Cuba's president at the time, Federico Bru. To embarrass the official, Bru retroactively canceled the Jews' visas. Nazi agents in Havana helped keep the Jews out, too, by spreading propaganda that turned the Cuban people against the refugees. The Germans didn't want the Jews in their country, but they also loved seeing the refugees turned away by other countries. To the Nazis, it was proof that everybody else in the world secretly agreed with the way the Germans were treating the Jews. Captain Gustav Schroeder was real, and he is remembered today for his kindness toward his Jewish passengers and his efforts to find refuge for them. Otto Schindig was real too, and was not only the Nazi Party representative on the ship, but also something of a spy, carrying secret messages back and forth between Germany and the Nazi agents working in Havana. Evelyn and Renata were the real names of two sisters whose mother chose to remain in Nazi Germany. Their father, Dr. Max Auber, was able to get them off the St. Louis in Havana because he had gone ahead of his family to Cuba and had strong connections with the local authorities. None of the other passengers were